Court of Appeals of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Judge Gibbons presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Be seated. We have two cases set today, 10 and 10:30, both involving professional negligence issues. It's no coincidence they're set at the same day, same time. I'm joined here today by Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left and Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. And we're very much looking forward to the arguments on these cases. The first case to be heard is case number 84978-COA, Engelson versus Dignity Health. We have Mr. Burris for the appellant. And we have actually two parties for the defendants. So who's going to be arguing, or are two people going to be arguing? Okay. All right. What is your name? All right. You're going first?
Yes.
Are you dividing the time equally or close to it?
Not equally, probably. I'll take the majority and give it 5 minutes.
All right. Thank you. And, okay. And are you all right going second and with less time? All right, glad you worked that out already. Mr. Burris, do you want to reserve any time for a rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor, and I may ask, the time is to be apportioned 15 minutes for us and 15 minutes for them.
Yes, I'm glad you asked for clarification on that, because the time remains the same no matter how many parties there are, unless some special arrangements are made ahead of time, which there are not in this case. So do you have an approximate amount of time you want to save for rebuttal?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Judge Bullitt, do you want to say anything before we start?
Good morning. It's very nice to see everyone today, and we look forward to the arguments.
Thank you. Judge Westbrook.
I echo Judge Bulla's statements as well. Good morning, and we're looking forward to some lively argument today.
All right, we'll proceed with the Engelson side. Mr. Burris.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the court. I represent the plaintiff and appellant in this case, Lenore Meyer, deceased. I think it's good to start with a minute on what is the standard of review for a motion to dismiss. The standard is that the order to dismiss shall not be upheld unless it appears beyond a doubt, not just a reasonable doubt, but beyond a doubt, that plaintiff could not prove any set of facts that would entitle her to relief. Also, it is said that under a motion to dismiss, you must construe the pleadings liberally.
Mr. Burris, your opponents in this case have argued that a summary judgment standard applies.
Yes.
Respond to that.
If it is a summary judgment, then the court must construe the evidence in a light most favorable to the losing party, in this case, the plaintiff. I wanted to hit on what I think are three main reasons why the order must be reversed. First of all, in a case involving the death of a plaintiff who allegedly was made to die by medical malpractice, the statute of limitations starts to run on the date of death. It's undisputed in this case that my client died on September 14th, 2020, and that the complaint was filed on September 14th, 2021.
Well, Mr. Burris, there seems to be a dispute as to whether or not your complaint actually alleges wrongful death. Can you address that, please?
Yes. Under our notice pleading, we only have to give a short and plain statement giving notice to the other side. And in our complaint, we said not once but twice that the negligence proximately caused, or actually the word was contributed to the death of plaintiff. Now that's stated twice in the complaint. And I think it's noteworthy that the defendants in this case in contesting the wrongful death claim didn't really complain that they didn't have notice of a wrongful death claim. Rather, they focused on the expert's declaration that they said didn't state causation of wrongful death.
You also pled survivorship. You have a survivorship action in your complaint, correct?
Yes.
Do you think that the survivorship action and the wrongful death claim, as you have pled it, is mutually exclusive?
No. In many cases, you allege a wrongful death, but you also want to leave the room open for if the jury doesn't connect the death, and then it's just a regular case. So these are theories that at least our firm will commonly plead both a wrongful death and just a regular estate action. I admit in this case the complaint was not artfully done, but it does state, give notice of both types of causes of action.
What is Gina Engelson's relationship to Lenore Meyer?
Daughter.
Daughter, okay. Yes. And where in the record is their relationship set forth?
I'm not aware of what exactly is in the record, but I know in our petition for appointment of a special administratrix, which is part of this case, it's alleged she's the daughter.
Okay. Thank you.
The defendants make the argument that the expert's declaration must state causation. I would point the court to our brief. The legislative history makes clear that that was expressly considered and not put into NRS 41A. It's not in the statute that causation is required. It's been my experience with the district courts. Other than Judge Peterson, no one has bought into this causation has to be in the declaration argument. If they wanted to put it in the statute, they could have done so, and it wasn't just something that was left out by mistake. They intentionally left it out. The defense cites two unpublished cases that they say require causation in the declaration, but if the court wants to look at these unpublished cases, they don't say that. They're both cases about the affidavit did not specifically lay out what things were done wrong as far as the bad actors were concerned. They aren't talking about the affidavit didn't have causation in it, therefore we're dismissing. Number two, the accrual date is a matter for the jury. In this case, the court found it was irrefutable, quote unquote, that the plaintiff learned of the bed sore on August 11th. And there's nothing in the evidence that indicates that. Just because the medical provider noted bed sores doesn't mean the plaintiff did. This deceased was very elderly, sick on medications. The bed sore was on the sacral area where she can't see it. And her heir, the daughter, couldn't come in and visit because of COVID restrictions. So at the very least, it's a matter of fact to just say it's irrefutable that the plaintiff and the daughter knew about it on August 11th is not supported by any evidence. That is a matter of fact that should go to the jury. And lastly, We believe there is claims for ordinary negligence, and we believe that under ordinary negligence, the statute is 2 years.
Mr. Burris, would you agree that paragraphs 15 and 38 of your complaint identify more than a dozen actions by both respondents that fell below the standard of care for nurses?
I'll take your honor's math to be correct.
Okay. But, well, then the math doesn't matter, but you've specified very, very specifically different actions that you contend were professional negligence. And my question is, where you've already specified that every single one of those actions fell below the standard of care for nursing, how can you argue that any of those same actions sound in ordinary negligence?
Your Honor, I think some of the, many of the actions specified in the complaint are, as you say, professional negligence by the nurses. But I wanted to concentrate on these three things that are mentioned in our expert's declaration, which is incorporated into the complaint. One is that the plaintiff deceased was laying in her own feces. Second is she was not being cleaned of bodily fluids. And third, she was not being taken to the bathroom when she needed to go to the bathroom. Now, I would say that those three things are something that anyone who's taking care of a child or toddler knows. It requires no medical knowledge not to let someone lay in their own feces and not be cleaned of it. And we know that leads to rashes. So as to those three things, we believe that those are ordinary negligence.
So are those the only three actions that you contend to be ordinary negligence?
Yes.
Okay.
I think the we agree that the Curtis decision says training and supervision is not is professional negligence, not ordinary. And the other things alleged could require special medical training and knowledge, but not cleaning the sacrum area of feces, not taking the patient to the bathroom, those are ordinary negligence.
And yet they're included in the affidavit of merit in this case.
They are, but the complaint states that the affidavit is incorporated by reference.
Oh, correct.
Yes.
But those were identified as
yes.
professional negligence by your expert in this case.
Yes. So in conclusion, we believe the law wisely disfavor cases being dismissed, motions to dismiss or motions for summary judgment. The law favors cases proceeding to court on the merits. And we believe in this case, the doors to the courtroom were prematurely and inappropriately closed to plaintiff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. All right, Ms. Erling, you may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Candace Hurling, and I represent the respondent, Sage Creek Post Acute. Your Honors, the heart of this matter is that the nature of allegations and the legal framework that governs these claims. Here, the district court properly concluded that the allegations in plaintiff's complaint against Sage Creek sounded in professional negligence and thus were subject to the provisions of NRS 41A regarding the statute of limitations and the affidavit of merit. Moreover, the district court properly denied appellant's motion for reconsideration and concluded that appellant's complaint and the expert declaration failed to raise an action for wrongful death in compliance with NRS 41A071. The complaint clearly sounded in professional negligence against Sage Creek, as Sage Creek does fall squarely within the purview of NRS 41A, given that the essence of the appellate's case revolved around the alleged failure of Sage Creek nurses to meet the standard of care. As established in Curtis, skilled nursing facilities, including Sage Creek, can indeed be subject to the provisions of NRS 41A when you're seeking vicarious liability of Sage Creek through the actions of the healthcare providers. The differentiation between ordinary and professional negligence is attempted by the appellate contemplates, it collapses under scrutiny, seemingly basic elements of medical care, such as the hygiene, lying in the feces, not being bathed, are within the purview of the medical care and treatment as indicated by the Nurse Marsh's affidavit that was included in the complaint, as Justice Westbrook pointed out.
Ms. Erling, I do have a question, and it relates to the standard of review on appeal. So your client and St. Rose both contend that the district court considered evidence outside of the pleadings when ruling on the motion to dismiss, and both of you have asked us to review the case under a summary judgment standard. So, but from what I can tell, all of the evidence that was attached to the motion work below, it was either, you know, unpublished cases or the executive orders, which also carry the force of law, or documents that came from the disc that was attached to plaintiff's complaint. So aside from the legal authority, did you present the district court with any evidence that did not originate on that disc that was itself attached to the complaint?
Your Honor, we did not present the district court with any evidence that was outside of what was actually filed with the complaint. With the complaint, it included the affidavit of merit by Nurse Debbie Marsh, the memo of expert that was generated, assumingly by the attorney's office that was attached there, and then I believe the case law that was also attached.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Herlane, let me ask this question. Would you agree that the one-year statute of limitations is the discovery of the legal injury, which is not necessarily triggered by knowledge of a physical injury?
Your Honor, the statute of limitations in this case was, there was irrefutable evidence that the legal, that the decedent knew of her legal injury at the latest upon arrival at St. Rose Siena and after she left Sage Creek, which the district court properly concluded was at August 11th.
Okay, but Kevin, that seems to be different from the argument that you raised below. So I looked, you know, in the joint appendix at page 35, the argument that you made to the district court was that the statute of limitations began to run as soon as the plaintiff, which is Ingleson, had enough information to believe that Ms. Myers' healthcare providers were professionally negligent. And the fact that Ms. Myers' family had contact with her during her stay at Sage Creek, and because Ms. Meyer complained to her family members, you contended that Ingleson was on inquiry notice of the claim sometime during Meyer's stay, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the district court adopted that position as well, took it that from the perspective of Ingleson, she, the court found irrefutable evidence that Ingleson herself had that knowledge.
Correct, Your Honor.
So you would agree for purposes of this appeal, our relevant consideration is whether Plaintiff Ingleson knew or had reason to believe that Meyer had a professional negligence claim at the time she was at Sage Creek.
For the purposes of this appeal, Your Honor, the district court, they correctly considered that and found irrefutable evidence within the complaint that family members were being contacted, because it says so in the expert declaration by Nurse March, and also again in the memo of expert that was detached from the attorney's office as filed with the complaint, that the decedent was calling to those family members and everyone was on notice of that she was complaining about substandard care at Sage Creek post-acute and then showing up at Siena with a worsening bed sore in that case.
So the relevant knowledge is on the part of the plaintiff, correct?
Yes, correct.
And the plaintiff being Ingleson.
Meeting Lenore Meyer, the estate of Lenore Meyer in this case. Lenore Ingleson is simply in the shoes as the administrator of the estate of that.
So Ms. Herling, bed sores can happen without negligence, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so if we consider your argument then, are you saying that every time a bed sore manifests itself in a patient and a patient complains about it, that your facility engaged in malpractice?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Because what worries me about your argument or gives me pause is that it seems that you would need to have legal support for your argument in the form of an affidavit or a expert review. And that's not something that would necessarily happen August 11th when they realized there was a bed sore. That might not happen until after they received the medical records, have an expert review, and then are able to articulate whether or not the bed sore that existed was actually due to negligence versus some other reason, i.e. non-negligence.
Correct. Your Honor, I understand. And yes, not every, just because a bed sore develops is not necessarily due to negligence. However, in this particular case, the decedent was calling to the family members, and it's detailed in the complaint, and that's why the court found that there was irrefutable evidence as to when the statute of limitations began to run, and was suggesting that she was receiving substandard of care. When she arrived at Sage Creek Post Acute, it's also detailed in the complaint that she knew that she had the bed sore on arrival, that it was a stage 3, and then was then told when she went to Siena that it was then a stage 4. So that's all alleged in the complaint and considered by the district court as, and should be considered as, irrefutable evidence as to that she was on notice of a legal injury when she's complaining about the care and treatment, equating that care and treatment to the worsening of those bed sores in this particular case.
So as a court, we should consider what the party complains of or the plaintiff complains of versus what might be in the medical records?
Your Honor, in this case, this was on a motion to dismiss. This was written at, you know, in their complaint, and the court properly considered what was true in the motion to dismiss when making its decision on the statute of limitations, and that there was inquiry notice by the plaintiff, by the estate of one of Ms. Meyer, that that her legal injury had occurred sometime after the admission at Sage Creek, which was August 11th.
But are the truth of the allegations to be taken on behalf of, in this case, the respondents, or are they supposed to be taken on behalf of the appellant as being true? I mean, are the allegations supposed to favor the respondents or the appellant?
The allegations are supposed to be taken in the light most favorable to the appellant in this case, which if we look plainly at the complaint and at the declaration and the attachment of the memorandum of the expert detailing that she knew she had the bed sore when she left Siena, that it worsened when she got back to Siena in between the stay at Sage Creek, had complained about that substandard care. Plaintiffs have detailed that she complained that she was lying in her own feces, not being cleaned, not being bathed, but then Nurse Marsh opining that the nurses all fell below the standard of care in their care and treatment there. Plaintiff was again on inquiry notice of her legal injury at that time.
What about the fact that the deceased was elderly? There's some records that indicate that she was having mental function issues. You know, why are we not construing those facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff in this case?
Understood, Your Honor. However, in the complaint, they've also detailed that that decedent, despite that she may be elderly and frail and maybe have some mental faculties that are at issue, she's complaining to family members, and it's also clearly stated that that was also recorded. If you look at the memorandum of the expert that's attached to the complaint, it references the recordings that the family has of the decedent making those complaints.
But does the document state that those recordings contain information about the bed sore itself? Or are you reading that into the memorandum? Because as I read it, I did not see any indication of what specifically the family members were told.
In the memorandum to the experts, it specifically says that the family has recordings of Lenore saying that she was treated horribly, lying in feces, having brain sensations, not getting help when she needed to go to the bathroom. She was, etc. Lenore was at Sage Creek for that.
How is that connected to the bed sore?
That is connected to the bed sore because in the complaint, if we look back at the complaint, in the expert affidavit, the expert shows that she reviewed records that showed that the decedent had told the family that the decedent's family was aware that bed sore had worsened when she arrived there on Siena. I'm going to conclude and give over my time to my co-defendant to take over a little bit of the wrongful death issues. Thank you for your time, Jenna.
Thank you very much, Ms. Harling. All right, Mr. Webster.
Morning, Chief Judge Gibbons, Judge Bulla, Judge Westbrook. My name is Ken Webster. I represent Dignity Health, doing business as St. Rose Sienna. Plaintiffs have repeatedly stated, unmitigatingly, unquestionably, and repeated here today, that this is a wrongful death case sounding in medical malpractice. And as Judge Westbrook pointed out during the questioning, there are at least a dozen specific instances of professional negligence alleged in plaintiff's complaint.
Mr. Webster, how do you respond to Ingleson's argument that they're stating both a survivorship and a wrongful death claim?
So it's an interesting thing, Your Honor. If you look at the original complaint that was filed, it is filed as Ms. Ingleson on behalf of the estate of Ms. Meyer.
Well, and you can do that in connection with a wrongful death claim as well.
You absolutely can. But what becomes the operative fact and what is unquestionable, as Mr. Burr stated himself, the undeniable, unmitigated fact is that she died on September 14th, 2020. So at the very latest, our statutes of limitation begin to run for the wrongful death claim or survivor action at that point.
And he filed exactly 1 year after that.
Exactly 1 year on the question. And that's what we point out in our brief, is that the issue then becomes, does 41A apply? Is this a professional negligence case? And I think under the litany of cases decided by our Supreme Court, and as stated by Mr. Burris today, unquestionably, this is a professional negligence case. 41A applies. Okay. The identity that he provided to, in response to your question, Judge Westbrook, that laying in feces, not being cleaned, and not being taken to the bathroom are specifically enumerated in the affidavit of the expert as below the standard of care. I think it's important to know that simply being in feces for any period of time does not necessarily mean that it's medical negligence or that it's professional negligence. Okay. You have to have an expert come in and say, what's an appropriate hygiene schedule? What's the period of time that requires a person to be clean?
And didn't the expert do those things?
She did not, and that is not within the ken of ordinary laity. A regular person with common knowledge is not going to be able to say the minute that you have a bowel movement in bed, you've got to immediately be cleaned or you're going to develop a stage 3 ulcer. It doesn't exist. You have to have an expert come in and talk about the physiology of skin breakdown and exposure to toxic chemicals.
But Mr. Webster, that's causation that you're discussing right now, correct?
100%. It's got to be a medical malpractice case, standard of care violation, which establishes what period of time a person can be reasonably within the standard of care in a bed where they've had a bowel movement.
So, counsel, are you aware that the definition of professional negligence changed in 2015? It used to contain causation and damages as part of that definition. And in 2015, that was removed from the definition.
100%.
Okay. What, in your opinion, is the significance of that?
Sure. It's significant from a causation standpoint in terms of the definition of professional negligence, but as it relates to whether or not 41A applies, you have to look at standards of care. What would a reasonably prudent person do in the same or similar circumstance? In this case, a nurse. The minute, the second that a person has a bowel movement in their bed and they're left to lay in it under the standard of common knowledge, that would be the indicator that there's a standard of care violation or it's ordinary negligence. That's not true. That is absolutely not something that we expect of healthcare providers. It's not opined to by Ms. Marsh.
Okay, assuming we agree with you that Chapter 41A applies,
mm-hmm.
Why is the declaration in this case insufficient simply because it doesn't address causation?
Because it doesn't address the injury in this case. All she says, if you look at the complaint specifically on paragraph 6, she's talking about the allegations that she has specific to Sage Creek, and then she has an independent statement at the end that says it denied her the opportunity for a better outcome. It says nothing about that. And under 41A071, that affidavit has to establish the foundation for all complaints or all allegations made in the complaint.
Supports the allegations contained in the action, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in Zohar, was there any requirement stated that causation needs to be part of that declaration?
It doesn't, Your Honor, but they don't even link in this case. They don't even get referenced in this case at all.
Mr. Webster, I just have a couple of questions. I know we're over time. Go ahead, and ask them. The first one is, I don't believe anyone challenged the affidavit below, the actual affidavit of Nurse Marsh below as being insufficient as an affidavit of merit.
We took it at its word.
Okay. So that issue is technically, I don't believe, in front of us in terms of the affidavit of merit in and of itself being sufficient. But second of all, I guess my question for you is, how do you distinguish when that the accrual date is typically a question of fact for the jury? And indeed, if it is a wrongful death case, it was timely filed.
So it was timely filed, but it was void ab initio in the way that it was filed because it didn't comply with the affidavit requirements from Ms. Marsh, because it didn't even reference the injury in this case, the very purpose for which Mr. Burr states he filed his complaint. As to your earlier question, Your Honor, I think it was a legal injury question. I apologize.
Right. I did ask the question, isn't the one-year statute triggered by the legal injury?
100%. So the legal injury is simply something, it doesn't have to be actual notice. I think you asked the question of Ms. Herling earlier, is doesn't it require an expert affidavit? If bed sores can happen in the absence of negligence, don't you have to have an expert affidavit in order to know that you have a legal cause of injury? That's not the standard that's enumerated by Massey or its progeny in our jurisdiction. What it says is that you have to have a reasonable set of facts to put you on inquiry notice of the potential for a claim. In this case, you have unmitigated evidence. If you look at the affidavit of the expert, she talks about the transfer from Sage Creek back to Siena on August 12th, where she describes in quotation marks, a huge bed sore down to the bone. And you have family members who are in constant telephone communication with the patient, who then complain to the nursing administrators about the quality of care that she's receiving. That is sufficient, irrefutably demonstrated evidence that this family was on notice of the injury that they had and their concerns about the care that led to it. Because the quotation marks of huge bed sore down to the bone are not the kind of things that you're going to find in the medical record. That comes from information that she would have received from Mr. Burris or through a memorandum that they received from the family. That is not the way medical providers talk about bed sores. They knew of the injury. They knew of their concerns related to it. They were on inquiry notice of the need to investigate their legal cause of injury. They don't have to have an expert declaration saying they violated the standard of care. It's not the requirement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Webster. We'll go back to Mr. Burris. You have close to 5 minutes.
Thank you. The counsel for Sage Creek said that the complaint says that the deceased knew of the bed sore. I don't believe that to be true. That's not alleged in her brief. The basic argument, at least in the briefs and court below, was that, well, if the deceased was complaining about bad care, then by clear inference, the heirs must know about the bed sore. And that's a great leap of faith. A bed sore on the sacrum is not going to be seen by anyone. Even if they went in there, they're not going to see it, and they were prevented by COVID from going in there. And bed sores on the sacrum that are stage 4, by definition, are down to the bone. So he's saying that because we use the phrase down to the bone, that means the heirs must have known there was a bed sore there, because doctors never say a bed sore is down to the bone. And I don't even agree with that, but it's certainly a factual issue.
How do you respond to Ms. Herling's argument that as long as Lenore Meyer was aware of the bed sore and was aware that she was receiving improper treatment, that is sufficient to put her on inquiry notice?
Well, first of all, I don't know that she was ever aware there was a bed sore there. I mean, the fact is, bed sores on the sacrum don't cause pain. I mean, that's a little secret that I don't like to come out on bed sore trials. But the nerve group in that area doesn't cause pain. And if you can't see it, and there's nothing in the records or anything that I know that says she knows it, but let's just assume for sake of argument she knows about it, then Justice Bullock points out that just because you have a bed sore doesn't mean that you're on notice that there's a malpractice claim. I mean, I have, in every bed sore case I have, they have numerous experts saying bed sores are commonplace and are not the result of negligence usually.
But when you couple that with the evidence of poor treatment, does that then, as Ms. Herling argues, put her on inquiry notice that she has a claim effective August?
Now, I would venture to say the majority of people in nursing homes, all of them, complain that the treatment is bad and they want to come home. And as far as the relatives of the people in the nursing home thinking that treatment is poor, that probably encompasses the majority of sons and daughters who have their parents in a nursing home. If every time someone in a nursing home says, I don't like it here, I want to come home, and the son or daughter says, I don't like this treatment there, that means there's a malpractice claim, then I would suggest that more than a great majority of the people in nursing homes are on inquiry of malpractice. And that simply isn't the case. That's just a subjective feeling that, you know, I don't like being here and they're not taking care of her like I would if mom was at home. That's certainly not inquiry of malpractice. If there are no further questions, I rest.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Burris, Ms. Herling, and Mr. Webster. Very good arguments from all of you. We really appreciate it. Very helpful on the both factual and legal issues in this case. So this matter will stand submitted for a